Thank you.
If anyone has any observations, questions, thoughts, now would be the time to put those in the put a queue, put your name in the speaking queue. Or yeah, Howard's put his name in the speaking queue. So Howard, please feel free.
Sure. Thanks, Mark. Can I first of all make an observation in regard to what Mike said earlier? Before we started, he said that the chair often abuses his or her position by speaking all the time. I'm sorry, I've not seen that at all. Generally speaking, chairs for these meetings have been extremely discreet. They're entitled to say a few words themselves now and then to offer an opinion. But the idea that they somehow dominated it is quite wrong, in my opinion. So what I would say to you, Mark, is that don't scruple at all if you've got the odd comment to make, which isn't simply part of your role as chair. Don't hesitate to make it. I think we'd all value it. That's what I've got to say, sort of, with regard to that. If I can just say another word about what Pat said, which was extremely interesting, and the way she sort of pulled the threads together at the end, I thought was very impressive. Her reference to William Morris was very apposite. The idea that what capitalism cannot offer is economic equality. Inequality is built into the system. That's what socialism is. It's equality. It's not equality of everyone being the same. It's equality of everyone having the same access to goods and services. And without that, as Pat said, there cannot be social progress. So, you know, despite the fact that living standards have improved dramatically since the First World War and since the Second World War, nobody can deny that. And they've even improved over the last 20 years, despite everything everyone's been through and so on. For some people, things are still pretty bad, very bad, even in this country, let alone in other parts of the world. But despite that, we're still in the same basic position, and we'll remain there until there's a broadening, an increase in, what can I call it? Well, socialist consciousness, if you like. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Howard. And I take your comments to heart. I have one or two thoughts up my sleeve. Mike, you're next in the speaking.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Mark. Howard, I didn't actually say that. I said occasionally some members do go on a bit, but I did disagree strongly with what you said. I said, but going back to the subject, more and more we get gadgets we rely on. And that really is, a prison of gadgets we're in these days. I mean, I'm an old-fashioned retired person. I live a very low, old-fashioned lifestyle. And I keep coming up with, you have to have a mobile phone to get on the net, to get in touch with somebody. I tried to get a P60 yesterday. You have to have a mobile phone to contact them. So I'm raising a complaint about it. But I'm one of the 2% that doesn't have a mobile phone. I don't have a microwave. I don't have TV. I have most of these gadgets I don't use. But I find it, funny that so many people are letting themselves be dominated by the gadgets. They have to watch this TV. They have to see this particular program, this particular movie. They must listen to this particular item. It's crazy. I like the way humans have invented or reinvented sanitation these days. That's spreading slowly throughout the world. That's quite a good idea. It was invented 2,000 years ago or even 4,000 years ago in some places. And I like the idea of the food coming out. There's more food being produced. I'm very careful about food. I don't want communal kitchens in a social society because I eat at different times than most people. I stay up all night sometimes if the sky is clear, and I have late dinner about 4 o'clock in the morning, and breakfast about 12, stuff like that. And I'm not a good cook, so I don't want to end up being always having to do the washing up because I'm terrible at cooking. But I'm quite a very low energy lifestyle. But Howard, I'm still annoyed about you. I think the chair should be the person on the speaking to you as well as anybody else. That's all I said. So you don't have to get on your high horse again.
Okay, and Freddie made a comment, but I don't think Freddie wanted to speak, so I'll go through to Moggy. Moggy.
Right, hello everyone. Thank you, Pat. That was a great talk. Now, what I wanted to just ask was, do you think that, okay, we've got lots more home comforts these days than people had 100 years ago. We take a lot of things for granted. But do you think people's stress levels have gone up accordingly? Now, I came to live in New Zealand 54 years ago. And the first thing that struck me when I came here was that nobody knew about stress. No matter what went wrong, people would say, she'll be right, mate. In other words, don't worry about it. Everything will be all right tomorrow. And I liked that attitude because everybody was very laid back. Nobody got upset or stressed or worried. Oh, you never hear people say that now. You know, the stress levels have gone up. It seems to be the trendy thing now for people to be suffering from stress. People are constantly under pressure for work or for finance, everything. People are constantly under stress. And I think it's a terrible thing. And I'm so pleased that I'm not part of the rat race. I'm pleased that I'm retired. I might be as poor as can be, but I don't have to go out working for an employer and having the stress levels that people have got these days. So just wondering whether you think that is exactly the same in England and whether that is the price we have to pay for having a few extra home comforts, like having nicely heated homes and being able to get what we want from the supermarket and being able to run a hot bath whenever we want one and that sort of thing. Right, that's me.
Yeah, please go ahead, Pat. I'm sorry I didn't refer back to you in the previous
That's right. I'll just comment. I don't think it's having the comforts that give stress. I mean, it's all the other things. It's the people having to earn a living, basically, but the time that the way it's done. I mean, towards the end of the 19th century, there was the victory of having an 8-hour day. Well, now so many workers do 12-hour shifts, and that's the normal. And I think for some they have, you know, so many days working and then whole days off to compensate. But I don't think it really does. I think that a 12-hour shifts really aren't very good at all. It's a backwards step. And I think that the stress levels is because of the problems that people have. I mean, people seem more likely to sort of lose their temper. There's not the there's this sort of divide and rule thing. I don't know if anyone sort of sits down and plans that there be people be divided, but it certainly happens that people are divided from other people and from people in other countries, and I think it the whole business is just stressful.
If you could, Pat, remember to mute yourself after you make.
Oh, sorry.
You'll be coming in and out. So, Mike Foster.
Thank you. And thanks especially to Pat for a very interesting, informative talk. I learned a lot on that. And The point I was going to make, well, one of the points, Moggy just made it much better than I, much better than I could have done. That, yeah, stress levels and sort of broadening out to mental health issues. They're more recognised now than in previous decades. But I'm sure, yeah, that there hasn't been progress regarding the overall mental health of people, and I can echo the stress side of things. Yeah, I'm a bit of a bad mood after a long day, which included 3 hours of unpaid overtime, I'll probably regularly do maybe about five six hours a week, more than I should do and more than I get paid for. So yeah, I'm a bit of a grumpy mood, which maybe echoes some of Moggy's points about stress after a tough week at work. But another area where I think there's been where there hasn't been progress and a decline is in housing. There's much more overcrowding now than in the sort of second half of the 20th century, and. In the homeless sector over the last 20 years, the phrase sofa surfing crops up these days much more than it used to. And that's, you know, sort of kipping over on someone's settee. Again, I'm sure it's always happened and maybe it's partly just more recognised these days. But there certainly seems to be more overcrowding. And whereas in previous decades, a young family might have more easily been able to move into a house. It now seems that young families... have to spend much longer renting before they can get a mortgage. I think the average age of getting a mortgage over the last 10 years or so has gone up. I think, again, that's one of the signs that housing, that there's no progress there. And I think, yeah, other things seem to have ground to a halt as well, like life expectancy. I think that's ground to a halt. And social mobility as well. I think that's something that's slowed down. So to me, social progress might have peaked maybe, I don't know, late 90s, perhaps a few years into the 21st century. But there seems to have been a reversal on a lot of trends which were otherwise heading in a more positive direction. But I don't know, maybe it's just me being in a bad mood that's coloured my thoughts. But I think there's reason to be pessimistic about the whole social progress issue, unfortunately. Thank you.
Do you have anything to come back on that, Pat?
Yes, I would just say on the social progress having peaked, and I would agree. The exact sort of year, I don't know, but... there was this sort of thing of people having their children doing better in life than they had done, and education being seen as a key to having a better life, and there was the improvement, but now it that seems to have stopped, and you have so many people getting it, if you like, better educated in the sense of going to university, but not being able to get the jobs afterwards. And, how much sort of the improvement sort of goes sideways somehow. It's how much change is really necessary. How much improvement on, apart from sort of obvious things that do need improving, but how much of it is really necessary? It's a sort of sideways, and it's a sort of what I think of as a sort of perversion of progress of what has happened, that capitalism did its job, but now it really stands in the way of progress. And, that's it really, I guess.
So, Darren.
Hello. First of all, thank you, Pat, for the talk. I guess Mike actually was basically said a lot of things I was going to ask about, and that's basically, has progress peaked? Was like welfare state capitalism, which for all its problems, you know, the redistribution of poverty basically, was that kind of like this post-war aberration which existed for like maybe three generations and has been slowly chipped away? And are we kind of maybe returning to a more normal kind of capitalism of a precariat, you know, people being precarious? You know, you read, if you like for the working class prior to the welfare state, it was very precarious in terms of their health, in terms of their jobs, in terms of housing. And it does seem to be more of a shift back towards that. So I guess I'm kind of wanting to ask Pat if are we just, this progress that we're talking about, is it something that's already been and gone? And on the issue of like when people, this idea of happiness, what Mike was saying about the 90s, it kind of reminded me of a book I read many years ago by a guy called Alwyn Turner. He wrote a series of books, big social histories of Britain, and he wrote one about the 70s. I think it was called Crisis, What Crisis? And it was part of a series of, there was a lot of books about the 70s a few years back, because there's almost like a form of revisionism, because a lot of people think 70s was so terrible and that's why we had Thatcherism, you know, the sick man of Europe, blah, blah, blah. And social historians, whatever, did research into Britain, and apparently the happiest Britain ever was 1976, in terms of like social cohesion. Apparently it was 76 was, there's always been a gap between the rich and the poor, obviously, but apparently it was a wee bit smaller than 76 in comparison to before and after. And then after that, it's been obviously been downhill, you know. But I just wanted to ask Pat if you feel that this social progress that we talk about has kind of disappeared because people are more stressful, because the jobs, you know, the next generation aren't necessarily going to have the better life than their parents had, etc. Life expectancy is stalling, etc. You know, people are buying houses later because they can't afford to get on the property ladder. You know, are we basically talking about something which is kind of quaint when we talk about progress? No, we're just actually going to revert back to old-fashioned capitalism, pre-welfare state. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. The progress of, you know, people getting useful things in the home, you know, like having running hot water and all those things and that comfort, but in fact having less time to spend in the home because of the hours of people working, and I know that women consider it an advance for that they can go out to work, but I think they've sort of lost something. That something has been lost. When I think of my childhood and the prisoners of war, but after the war and people, that there was more of a communal thing with people talking over the garden fence, as it were. But once they going out to work, they've lost a certain amount of leisure, and I know it means that they can perhaps have holidays, and if there's not a pandemic, a holiday abroad. But I think something has been lost by it, which isn't to say that I think that, you know, we should all stay in the kitchen. But I'd like socialism really, because then we could really have a better time.
Steve Finch.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Really enjoyed your talk, Pat. And you left a lot of threads for people to pick up, and I'm just going to pick one up. When you mentioned about this, that was news to me when you mentioned the reduction in the minimum height for people to join the army after in 1904. 5 foot, that's I mean, imagine that, a lot of 5 foot people walking towards you, you'd be frightened. But the point is to pick up from that is that why at that stage in capitalist society was there this recognition of the need for some sort of social security in Britain? And it's precisely because they needed to ensure that there was a are working class healthy enough to go and die for it when it, I mean, I believe there were huge numbers of people rejected in the First World War as well. And so this becomes the motive for the type of social progress that you're talking about under capitalism. And and I mean, it's really, well, I mean, it's quite plain that that's one of the drivers for it. And just one other thing quickly, that to pick up a little on what Darren said about the precarious nature of society, some of the capitalists have got precarious existence, but let's talk about our class of precarious existence. It might not be as bad as the people in, for example, in India, in the COVID crisis that we've just seen, that people that are working on that they're actually one day or 2 days away from absolute destitution, which was why there was such a panic and why COVID was quite easily spread over there. But we've got in this country, we've seen the situation that people have got. We're possibly two months away from destitution, you know, and it's only with there's actually been a realization amongst the government that they've had to suspend evictions and things like that to maintain some sort of social control. But that's our situation as workers. However many microwaves you've got, however many televisions you've got, that is not going to protect you from being out on your ear any more than in the past, when in the 1930s, when people used to go around when the social, what the hell did they call them? I can't remember, but they used to send people around from Poor Law Commission to make people sell furniture before they got any type of national assistance. So we're not that much different. We've got these little bits. We've got carpets. We've got, just looking, we've got a hi-fi system. But if we stop working, we're absolutely shafted within 2 months, and that's something that makes. Is like a cloud on our lives. Okay.
Anything on that, Pat, or do you want to move on?
Yeah, I think in the First World War there was conscription in 1917, and I've just been looking for the figure, but I can't find it this minute. But I think out of the 2.5 million, I think 40% were unfit at that time. But in the early part of the 19th century, I think the expectation of life was about 45 years. Obviously, that's improved. But like Steve said, it's really ironic, you know, you've got to be fit to go and fight and die in the army. There was something else, I can't remember what it was, so I'll leave it there.
Okay, Paddy?
Yeah, just a couple of observations. People were talking about affluence and how it doesn't necessarily make you happy. I can't help thinking that Mike Brown was going on about he doesn't want to be imprisoned by a gadget. I thought the only reason he's able to tell us this is via a gadget. So, you know, it's really ridiculous to take an attitude against all gadgets. Some of them are really incredibly useful. The broader point about, affluence and happiness, I have looked into this in the past, actually, but it's quite interesting because what you tend to see is happiness does go up with affluence, but only up to a point, at which point it then plateaus, and it's plateaued in most of the advanced capitalist countries. So as affluence continues to increase, you don't see a similar increase in happiness. So people stay the same. That's possibly because of stress, has been pointed out. According to the World Gallup poll, Finland is the happiest country, and has been for the last 4 years. But according to a different poll, the Happy Planet poll, the happiest country in the world is Vanuatu, which is an island in the South Pacific, where they really are very poor, in fact. So, you know, you can read into that what you want. But the main thing I was thinking about was, we seem to have lost him, but we did have our Indian comrade here earlier, and I was wondering what he was thinking about this progress, because Pat's really, really good talk, really enjoyed it, and Pat did say, well, it's quite parochial, but it's true. And then if you look at the sort of progress at the global level, I mean, certainly in India, I think they would be wondering where all this progress is. I just checked because there are 732 million people in India who don't have access to a toilet. I mean, you would have thought that was a pretty basic human need. I mean, that was, you know, people in 1930s in Britain had access to a toilet, you know. So and in China, I think to this still, the number one killer diseases are pulmonary, because of the amount of cooking that has to be done on open fires. So, you know, people in China, millions of people don't have stoves in China. So, you know, this is, and the even bigger question is, this progress hasn't been equal, as we know, across the world. Inequality between countries has widened over the last century, so that since 1900, you know, while Africa and Asia were flatlining for most of that period to 1900 to 2000, the UK was rocketing along with some European countries and the US. And what I noticed was amazing. Forbes has got a sort of animated, if you want to check out on Forbes, it's got an animated chart of affluence by a country over the last century. And what you notice is that the UK doesn't even dip after 1945, when it's just fought an absolutely devastating world war. It doesn't even dip. It's still in the stratosphere compared to the African countries and South American places like that. So, and right now, when all these so-called developing countries are struggling to get up the ladder, you know, striving to get this progress that we've all had since the 1930s or even before that. Now, of course, the cry is, oh, my God, the planet can't afford it. Now we've got we're going to have runaway climate change. If all these people have stoves and central heating and air conditioning and all the things that Europeans and Americans, you know, regard as necessities or even rights, suddenly the planet can't afford it. So my general question is to Pat, has all this progress come at the cost of climate change? That's me.
Well, it certainly doesn't look very good, but I'm not quite sure what else I can say about that. We produce, there's more wasteful production than there needs to be. Because it's, I don't know, buying things is a pastime, and that the whole push is to you know, to make more and sell more and buy more. And as you know, it's the profit motive, and I heard you say that the other day that what we have to do is to stop doing some of these things, and I know that completely stop using parts of the ocean, and it does get better, and in the surrounding area from the part that where they stop using it does also improve, because our older fish produce more fish. But the answer is that we have to stop. But that doesn't mean that telling people in other countries, well, you can't have what we've got. And of course, it isn't true that everyone in the countries, everyone in India isn't without toilets and poor. But the poor are. I mean, beyond the spread of our ideas of changing, abolishing capitalism, I don't know, I can't suggest anything else. I mean, changes can happen within the system, and I very often hear the farming program in the morning and but suggestions that they have and things that they do to get the soil in improving and doing things in better ways. So things can be done, but there certainly has to be something much more, I was going to say drastic, that's not quite the right word, something much more revolutionary has to be done.
Freddie.
Yeah. Beg your pardon. Thanks, Matt. If I didn't know better, I'd have thought that perhaps Paddy could have been looking over my shoulder here at some notes that I'd put down, and Steve Finch also when it comes to that. Because some of the points that Paddy made, and Steve, as I say, I'd written them down. We were talking about destitution, talking about the global warming, etc. These are the points I want to make. That once we're the Socialist Party of Great Britain, we're part of the world socialist movement. And, you know, when we're talking about parochialism, just what's happening in this country doesn't just matter, I would say, what's happening here. It's what's happening globally that counts. And when you talk about, yes, there has been an improvement in living standards. But what's the cost of that been? What's the cost of these living standards been in terms of the mental health of people? Mike Foster just mentioned there earlier on about himself, and we discussed it, or it was mentioned a week or two back, about the amount of unpaid overtime that workers are engaged in. There's more people now in mental institutions and on antidepressants and anxieties and being analysed for all sorts of things because what capitalism is doing to us. So whether or not, you know, it depends how you want to gauge improvement in living standards. Having a toilet, having a bath, having a microwave, etc., fine. But it's the cost of that to the workers. It's the cost of that to society. It's the cost of that of the world. So it's how we're going to change this that matters, for me anyway. Thank you.
Anything on that, Pat?
On No, I have nothing to say. That. I don't agree with that.
Well, we don't have anyone else in the speaking queue, so I would encourage anyone who feels they want to say something to put their cue in. I just wanted to take the opportunity to kind of in light of various comments that were made. I was actually thinking in along the lines of course, social progress is just a name, a tag we use. But, you know, I'm just curious, Pat, as to whether you think that together with the, you've really talked about what I would call or what could be called material progress. But you also mentioned, you mentioned some comments about how, you know, people interact with each other. And I think you mentioned that there was less, let's say, less milk. You didn't use the term less milk of human kindness, but perhaps you, that was what you were getting at. People were more angry or something like that. So just a question in your, from your perspective, from your time, you know, in the party and keeping your pulse on the finger of the nation, keeping your finger on the pulse of the nation. You know, would you say that there has been, you know, if we define social progress not only as material progress, but progress in various other ways, and maybe more specifically what Howard mentioned right at the beginning, socialist consciousness, because or class consciousness, perhaps, because although they're very often the same, because, you know, you mentioned how organized people were in trade unions. And we know that trade unions don't mean socialist consciousness, but it does actually mean a certain or not a certain, a definite sense of belonging together as a class, fighting for common aims against a common enemy. You know, is there, just I'm throwing out some thoughts, is there an inverted relationship between, you know, material, as we are more materially better off, although not necessarily socially and not necessarily mentally, has class consciousness deteriorated? I mean, that would be my kind of just sort of suggestion that might have happened. I wonder what you think about some of those random thoughts before we go on to the next person.
Well, social progress, as I said, that there was really hardship in the pre-war period, and people in work, and there was an expression, I think, that we work and we want, and a sort of looking to things being better and thinking of education as being a key to things being better. But it's just how much better do people want them to be? I mean, it's this sort of the material possessions that... How much do you need? How much do you have to keep changing things for something, you know, something new, something different? And sort of communal spirit, as it were, that there was sort of during the Second World War and afterwards, but people have become more separated, more individuals, and the breakdown of relationships, of course, where the people, you know, they live together for a while and then not anymore, and all the problems that causes, which doesn't mean I want to force people to stay together, you know, when they shouldn't be, but they, you know, there's a general sort of there used to be a route that people were going to, and look at you know, you were leaving school and getting a job and you know, getting married and having children, whatever. But that route has changed, and all right, so there's greater freedom, but there all seems to be pluses and minuses about what happens to people that route has gone, plus the jobs that there used to be, and where I live, the main employers were Fords and the railways and the docks, but all those sort of set out routes were gone, and I might be quite pleased that people aren't going down the mines in the numbers that they were, but they still felt the loss of their community spirit, but that's all sort of that has changed, and there are people. Some people do have better lives, and individuals do, but on the whole, they're still. I mean, this sort of acceptance, as it were, of war, I find very hard to understand. And it seems terrible to me, remembering the end of the Second World War and the tangible relief there was. And I thought as a child, I thought, well, that's it, you know, the war's finished. In no time at all, there was the atomic bomb and the weapons testing and all sorts of wars and conflicts that's gone on. And I find it's so hard to, I mean, I remember air raids, and I just find it so hard that, to think that still goes on, if I say acceptable, I'm sure you understand what I mean, because it goes on, and you know, and I feel sorry for children, because I mean my worry is, as a child growing up, was about war and things, and now they're worried about the climate and other things, and the route to jobs is sort of different for people. And, I don't know, it's all these sort of stresses that I can't quite pull it all into words at the moment, but I find it all rather upsetting. Sorry about that.
Sorry, I'm still on the mic. Sorry, can I just one follow-up question? And that is, do you feel that people are less? I mean, are we less optimistic now than you are? I mean, and I want to go back to that socialist consciousness question just quickly, Pat. You know, has there been a? Do you feel there's been a decline in, if not consciousness, socialist consciousness, class consciousness? I'm just wondering what your impressions are, because you painted a very effective picture. So I'm hoping you'll continue painting.
Yes, well, I lead a rather isolated life these days. I don't know. That's the short answer, really. I think that things sort of do stand out sort of obviously to people in some ways, but it's what people hear said. And when in Chelmsford at some time giving out leaflets, and I think it was, I can't remember what the particular, except it was public sector workers, and the comments from people who worked in the private sector going past, they were very anti the others, you know, and instead of thinking, well, why aren't they doing better? But they seemed, well, you know, they're doing all right. Why are they sort of demonstrating? And I think the class consciousness, it ought to be there. And that was one of the points that I was sort of trying to make, that things haven't changed. It's still most people having to work for a living, and the others not needing to. And I don't know. I was sounding rather depressed, but as far as socialism goes, I always feel that we have to be optimistic. We have to talk. I mean, I remember in West Ham Branch, the first time I heard someone say, well, we know it's not going to happen in our lifetime. And that came as rather a surprise that he should say that. And sadly, that man did die quite young. But I think we have to have this sort of positive attitude that this is the answer for now, and for, you know, goodness sake, it's really, really necessary. But I can't really help out on the class. There's no reason why people shouldn't notice it. I mean, the what does stand out at the moment is, because of the pandemic and people not being able to work, and some getting, and I can't remember what it's called, what the government has paid to enable some employers to keep workers on. But the thing about money seems to be so sort of obvious at this time. And this sort of thing of you've got to go out and sell things and export things and compete and all the rest of it. And that I don't know. I suppose when you know, it's obvious, but I can't understand why it doesn't seem more obvious to other people, that the money, you know, money doesn't do anything. It's people that do things. I can't be more help than that, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was very helpful. Howard. Howard.
I think it was Darren who raised the key question of, has progress peaked? I don't think 20 years or so ago we would have asked this question. We had an old member of my branch, of Swansea branch, who... Phil Meller, who always used to say, we're not going to get socialism until capitalism has given the workers more and given them time to sort of to really think and reflect on the world they live in and how it could be a lot better. That was his view. If he were alive today, he'd be well over 100. This was in the 1990s. And You see, he'd seen massive, massive improvements in living standards over his lifetime. So as far as he was concerned, I think capitalism was, in fact, improving things for workers all the time. And even Marx said this in the 19th century, didn't he? However, it hasn't been a straight trajectory. There have been periods when things have got worse. For example, the slump of the 1930s, for a lot of people, things got worse, etc. Now, so it's being said that what's happened in the last 10 or 20 years shows that capitalism has given all it can give to workers and things are sort of going downhill. Well, I do think we should take a sort of broader perspective and not necessarily jump to that conclusion, not necessarily think that capitalism has sort of, shot its bolt in terms of what it could give and to workers, and things are going to be worse now than they were before. Maybe progress, it's just as likely that progress hasn't peaked. And this is a period when, things are sort of going slightly in the other direction. But, over a longer period, that might not be the case. We've now got to factor in this other element of the effect of the environment on producing more and so on and so forth, admittedly. But, capitalism has a habit of sort of, not exactly resolving problems, but sort of being resilient, coming to terms with them in one way or the other, as it has when many other problems arose in the past. Did anybody during the Second World War, for example, think that after the war there was going to be this sort of gradual and then sort of very considerable rising living standards and a lot more people were going to be a lot better off? Probably not. So, what I'm saying is that we've got to take a sort of wide look at things in a wider perspective before we not necessarily focus on what's happening right now in the last 5, 10 years or even in the last 20 years. It may just be a period in which things are going in a different direction than they will go in the longer term.
Anything you want to add to what Howard said or comment on that, Pat, or you're happy to go ahead?
To leave to that, that's fine.
Okay. Right. Is Brian there? If not, we could go on to Joel.
Hello,
Joel.
Yeah. Yes, just going back to the class consciousness thing, I think for people, it's still a touchy subject to sort of like when you talk about the working class, because for some people, they think the working class is like a term from sort of decades ago. And, they've fallen for this story they've been fed that we can all get on and... And like we've just been talking in the talk, we're saying this social progress, and I think it's still a difficult subject to talk to people about, sort of class, because some people they don't really understand what class consciousness is. I mean, they'd be quite more willing to sort of talk about how other people are taking jobs and that sort of angle, but in terms of seeing that we're all working class and our big problem is capitalism. I mean, it is for some people it's quite a jump to take. Thank you.
Do we have Brian? If not, then Pat, do you have anything to add to what Joel said, or shall we move on?
No, that was fine. Agree with that.
Okay, Adam Buick.
Yeah, just want to make a point about why the welfare state, so-called, was introduced. I don't think it was just to get recruits for the armed forces. I mean, that was one factor. But I think perhaps a more important one was to have a fitter, a more healthy and more productive working class. So the healthier workers are, the more educated they are, the more profits that they can produce. But whatever the reason, it has happened, and there has been social progress in the sense that each generation of workers has been better off than their parents. Now, I don't think this has affected so much class consciousness or socialist consciousness, but I think it might be one explanation as to why capitalism has continued beyond its sell-by date. It's a question, I suppose, of if you're having a slowly improving standard of living from generation to generation, people are prepared to settle for that rather than risk a complete social change. So that would be my take on that question of how social progress has affected consciousness. But there's one thing that Darren said that's intrigued me. He said that the year 1976 was the year that people were supposed to be the happiest. But one thing that didn't exist in 1976 was widespread ownership of houses. Most people then, I think, still rented property. And in fact, when I first came to London, the idea wasn't to buy a house. It was to rent property. Most people did rent property at that time. But since, I think it's the Thatcherite revolution, if you want to call it that, that encouraged people to buy their own houses. I mean, that I think is a major change since 1976. So whether that makes people happier, more happier or less happier, I don't know. But it certainly has an effect again on people's consciousness. I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. I find no problem with renting something. But when you own a house, of course, you have to pay for the maintenance of it. And people who did buy their apartment found themselves having to pay for the lifts and all that, whereas people have continued to be renting it from the council didn't have to pay that. But I think, as I say, social progress, house ownership, this sort of thing has affected people's consciousness, and it's made them unfortunately more prepared to put up with capitalism. I don't think that's a pessimistic conclusion. I think it's a factual one. Okay.
Paddy?
Yeah, well, just to add to what Adam was saying there, we're kind of back to that parochial view, though, aren't we? Because house ownership is certainly not the norm in a lot of other countries. I know it's not the case. It's not the norm in Spain. It's not the norm in Italy. A lot of people don't own houses in France. There's no expectation of it. In fact, I think some European countries kind of regard Britain as a bit strange in that way, that, there's this expectation of house ownership in Britain. And we don't see any sort of greater class consciousness in these countries where everyone expects to rent than we do here, I wouldn't have thought. So I suppose I'm disagreeing with Adam that is a particular factor.
So, comrades, it's coming up to 9 o'clock UK time. We don't have anyone else in the speaking queue. Maybe it would be a good time just to ask, would it be a good time to ask Pat to sort of round up if she has anything she wants to draw together here? If anyone does want to contribute, want to take something, Paula has just come on. So I think Paula wants to say something. So please, we're listening, Paula.
Okay, thank you. It's just something I wanted to ask Pat about, because I was really, first of all, I'd like to say I really enjoyed your talk. It was really interesting because I'm kind of familiar with conditions at the time that Engels was writing. And I'm familiar with conditions sort of from the 60s onwards. But I hadn't quite appreciated all this stuff about people at the turn of the century not having something as basic as a kitchen, for example. And actually, yeah, the whole kitchen thing really interests me, actually. Because you mentioned an author who wrote he wrote something about kitchens. Could you just remind me what it was he said and what his point was? It's a bit of a hobby horse of mine, because I think in a socialist society, we would have communal kitchens. We wouldn't have individual kitchens, just like we wouldn't all have our own washing machines. We'd maybe go back to the days of the steamy. because a lot of the way we live now, the reason we live this way in our individual little houses with our individual fridges and cookers and central heatings and all the rest of it is because that suits capitalism, because capitalism wants us to go out and buy washing machines and fridges and all the rest of it. Whereas it would actually, I think we'd all be a lot happier, even within capitalism, if we could just live more communally the way that we used to do, you know, in the in the days when we didn't have baths. We all went to the communal baths and we went to the steamy and so on. So Pat, if you could just maybe just expand a little bit more on what you were saying at the beginning about kitchens. Thank you.
Yeah, well, the author was August Babel, B-E-B-E-L. He was a German social democrat, and it was in his book on woman in the past, present and future. And he was concerned, in fact, it's many years since I actually read the book, but I did look up the particular the particular quotation again, and he was concerned about the quality of food, and he thought that the small private kitchen that it was in the individual household was an obsolescent institution in which time, power and material are thoughtlessly and extravagantly wasted. Then the entire preparation of food will be undertaken by society in the future. The private kitchen will disappear. And in addition to these central kitchens, we have central washing establishments, is what he said. And all clothing would be manufactured in central factories. Just before that quote, which did amuse me because I hadn't remembered that at all, that he was talking about the quality of food and there being a sort of a scientific basis. And he did say that women, I have got the book here, were not competent to do it. And I'm just walking away to pick the book. Incidentally, this was a very well-worn book that was given to me by a Maggie Hallard, a member of West Ham branch, after the very first meeting I spoke at. And it's an old book, but when I read it, there were uncut pages, which rather amused me at the time because it meant that I was the first one to actually read. And while I'm talking, I'm looking for the page so I can tell you just what he said. Here we are. It says, That women, to whom the preparation of food chiefly falls at the present day, neither can be in possession of the necessary knowledge that, and he said that's already been shown, neither do they possess the necessary apparatus, but machines for boiling, roasting, etc., in the greatest technical perfection, i.e. arranged according to scientific principles, may already be seen at work in the kitchens of every large hotel, in barracks and hospitals, and even at cookery exhibitions. The question to be solved is how to attain the best results with the smallest expenditure of power, time, and material. This question is of special importance when applied to human nourishment. And then he says, the small private kitchen in the individual household is therefore an obsolescent institution in which time, power, and material are thoughtlessly and extravagantly wasted. I won't go on that. He just say the nutritive value of food will be increased by its increased ease of assimilation, which will be the criterion of excellence. I was amused by the central washhouse establishment, because I thought of the people who could never pair up their socks after the wash day. What would happen if we only had central washing establishments? But anyway, that's who it was and where the quote came from. Is that all right, Paula?
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Thank you, Pat. That was really interesting. I totally get where Babel was coming from, absolutely. Apart, of course, from the fact that women weren't adequate to the task, which is obviously very insulting, isn't it? So we need men and we need science to take over this particular task, because they've obviously got a superior kind of intellect, I suppose. But apart from that, you know, I totally agree with his concept, actually. Absolutely. And, you know, going back to the days of the steamy, that used to be a thing where, you know, all the women in the neighbourhood, it was a chance for them all to get together. It was a very, from what I've heard, it was a very communal and jolly kind of experience. Not like now, where you've got to, you know, everything's private nowadays, isn't it? We don't have that kind of community anymore. And that adds to people's stress, of course. Thank you, Pat.
Well, that was fascinating. Thank you. That last part. Pat, do you want to draw it to a close now?
No, that seems like a good idea. If that's all right with everyone, I'll just say I think of socialism as being a whole life proposition, which is something, you know, so it's not just a question of having free access to goods and services, but a different kind of life. But I'm not sure for my part about the completely communal living. It would have to be a mixture, I feel, of communal and private living. But I mean, already people like to go out to eat. I know this last few months has been different, but there's a lot more eating out than there used to be, and things like that. Laundrettes have sort of come and largely gone, but not entirely gone. But anyway, to round up the evening, well, thank you all, and well, just look forward to the time when we can have more people looking at things in the same way, that real progress has got to be making things simply to be used, which would be a lot more economical way of doing things, not wasted journeys and so on, and duplication of things and things going in two directions, that making things simply to be used and in a more communal spirit that people have enjoyed during the pandemic, that was something that came out of that. But that's it, really. It's just that we have to just keep the ideas alive and keep on working at it. And I think that's about it. Look forward to the next meeting.
Well, on behalf of everybody, Comrade Pat, I'd like to thank you for this evening's talk, and I'd like to also thank everyone who contributed. There were a huge amount of interesting lines taken up, and I'm sure we could more or less a number of those contributions could be talks in themselves. So perhaps anyone who's made a contribution might think about what they might like to, how they might like to develop some of those things. I just want to remind comrades that on Wednesday there is going to be a talk, if the published schedule is still valid. There's going to be a talk by Glenn
Morris or a question and answer session, what's it like being a socialist? And on Friday next week, so a week from today, we've got an American comrade, Jordan Levi, who is going to be talking about the Paris Commune. And the title of his talk will be 150 years since the Paris Commune. And I'm sure that's going to be really excellent. So I encourage everyone to come back if you do go to the Wednesdays and on Friday to the Friday talk, because they both look very interesting. So thanks, everybody. Thanks, Pat. And see you.